Welcome to the March 21st, 2024 episode of Blood Podcast, your source for innovative ideas and cutting-edge information. Our topics are based on articles published in Blood, a journal of the American Society of Hematology. First on today's podcast, eculizumab in stem cell transplant-associated thrombotic microangiopathy. Use of the complement C5 inhibitor translated into high survival rates in children and young adults with high-risk disease, setting a benchmark for future studies. Up next, reclassifying malignant monocytosis. When applying updated WHO and ICC criteria, a significant proportion of cases are newly classified as chronic myelomonocytic leukemia, or CMML. These newly classified cases had distinct mutational and transcriptional profiles, but were not different from established CMML cases in terms of overall survival. Finally, targeting the tissue factor coagulation initiation complex prevents antiphospholipid antibody development. Inhibition with the nematode-derived inhibitor NAPC2 prevented prothrombotic effects in mice and the pro-inflammatory and prothrombotic activation of monocytes. These new data provide initial evidence for a treatment strategy with benefits beyond currently available anticoagulants. Let's start with our first research article, Prospective Multi-Institutional Study of Eculizumab to Treat High-Risk Stem Cell Transplant-Associated TMA. The first author is Sonata Jodel of Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center in Ohio. About 20 to 30% of children and young adults undergoing hematopoietic stem cell transplant will experience thrombotic microangiopathy, or TMA, a syndrome that stems from injury of small vessel endothelium. The clinical picture of TMA includes microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, thrombocytopenia, and often multi-organ injury. Patients with transplant-associated TMA are said to be at high risk if certain disease markers are present. One high-risk marker is terminal complement activation, as shown by elevated concentration of soluble C5b9 in the blood. And another is nephrotic range proteinuria, as quantified by random urine protein creatinine ratio. When both high-risk markers are present, outcomes are poor, usually due to multi-organ dysfunction syndrome, or MODS, which can be lethal if not promptly managed. So the present research by Jodel and co-authors focuses on whether TMA-targeted treatment improves survival in high-risk transplant-associated TMA. They looked specifically at eculizumab, a monoclonal antibody that binds complement protein C5. Binding C5 inhibits cleavage into C5A and C5B fragments, which impedes the formation of C5B9, also known as membrane attack complex. Eculizumab treatment is a logical strategy, given that in many patients, MODS develops due to endothelial damage mediated by complement activation. Previous studies have shown promising results of eculizumab treatment in patients with high-risk TMA. However, there have been no prospective studies in patients who develop TMA after hematopoietic stem cell transplant. Now, Jodel and colleagues report on a single-arm prospective multi-institutional study of eculizumab in patients with high-risk TMA at 3 pediatric transplant centers in the United States. All patients had high-risk features, including both plasma-soluble C5b9 and proteinuria, as identified by a random urine protein creatinine ratio of greater than or equal to 1 mg per mg. Patients received up to 24 weeks of eculizumab therapy, given according to a dosing regimen that incorporated intensive loading, induction, and maintenance phases. Eculizumab drug levels were monitored, as were levels of soluble C5b9. Dosing modifications were allowed for subtherapeutic drug levels or inadequate complement suppression. The goal was to determine whether eculizumab could at least double the survival reported previously for patients with untreated high-risk TMA. In a previous prospective observational study, the authors reported an overall survival of 9% in patients with high-risk TMA and MODS, and only 18% survived more than 6 months after diagnosis. A total of 21 evaluable subjects with high-risk TMA were evaluated, all of whom had MODS. Most were Caucasian children who had undergone a first hematopoietic stem cell transplant. The underlying transplant indication was malignant in 11 patients and non-malignant in 10. The median time to a diagnosis of high-risk TMA was 22 days after transplant. Eculizumab therapy was started a median of 2 days after that diagnosis, and the treatment was well tolerated, with no excess of infections and no adverse events attributed to the drug. The primary endpoint was survival at 6 months after a high-risk TMA diagnosis, and 15 study subjects, or 71%, were alive at 6 months. That contrasted sharply with the 6-month survival rate of 18% in the historical controls. The null hypothesis was rejected, and the primary endpoint was met, with a p-value of 0.0001. Of the 15 survivors, 11, or 73%, were well and had fully recovered organ function. In the 6 patients that died during the 6 months after the diagnosis of high-risk TMA, contributing causes were MODS, graft versus host disease, acute respiratory failure, and veno-occlusive disease. Additionally, the 1-year post-transplant survival rate was 62%. In the historical controls, the 1-year survival rate was just 16.7%. Altogether, authors say, their study demonstrates a significant improvement in survival and recovery of organ function with the use of an intensified eculizumab dosing regimen and real-time monitoring. They say this study should serve as a benchmark for planning future studies of prevention or targeted therapy initiated early to head off organ injury. Also in Blood is a commentary on this study, titled Averting a Terminal Transplant Cascade. The authors are Krishna Gundabalu and Vijaye Raj Bhatt of the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha. They say these study results are remarkable for several reasons. It's the first prospective multicenter clinical trial evaluating anti-complement therapy with eculizumab in transplant-associated TMA. Secondly, the investigators applied rigorous, biomarker-based criteria to diagnose and treat these seriously ill patients. Finally, the survival rate of 71% at 6 months after diagnosis of transplant-associated TMA and multi-organ dysfunction is impressive, and represents a 4-fold improvement over the dismal 6-month survival rate in the previous study. Several unanswered questions exist. For example, why did 1/4 of the patients die, despite meticulous complement inhibition and dose adjustments? And would this treatment approach be feasible in clinical practice, where biomarker measurement may be challenging? However, the commentary authors conclude, the current study of eculizumab represents a giant stride forward that opens up new avenues to build on this success. The next research article is Comparing Malignant Monocytosis Across the Updated WHO and ICC Classifications of 2022. And the first author is Francis Baumgartner of MLL Munich Leukemia Laboratory in Germany. The defining feature of chronic myelomonocytic leukemia, or CMML, is peripheral blood monocytosis when seen in conjunction with myelodysplastic or myeloproliferative bone marrow features. The cutoff used to define monocytosis is an absolute monocyte count of at least 1 times 10 to the 9th per liter, an arbitrary value introduced in 1982. In 2022, both the World Health Organization, WHO, and the International Consensus Classification for Myeloproliferative Neoplasms, ICC, introduced major changes to the diagnostic criteria for CMML. Notably, both the WHO and ICC lowered the cutoff for peripheral blood monocytosis to 0.5 times 10 to the 9th per liter. That effectively redefines cases formerly called oligomonocytic CMML as CMML. Oligomonocytic CMML included unclassifiable myelodysplastic syndromes, MDS, or myelodysplastic myeloproliferative neoplasms, MDS-MPN, with at least 10% peripheral blood monocytes and a total monocyte count between 0.5 and 1. Going by the previous WHO classification from 2017, most of these patients were considered to have MDS. But then studies showed that MDS with monocyte count between 0.5 and 1 had clinical and biological features comparable to CMML. And so, the cutoff was lowered to 0.5 in both updated classification systems. There are other significant changes to note in classification. The CMML0 subgroup was eliminated due to limited clinical relevance. This subgroup included cases with less than 2% blasts in peripheral blood and less than 5% in bone marrow. In addition, solely clinical diagnostic criteria were replaced. For example, persistent monocytosis in the absence of an alternative diagnosis, and new criteria for acute myeloid leukemia, AML, have impacted the classification of CMML. However, not all is harmonious. The WHO and ICC utilize different diagnostic criteria, which introduces two discordant definitions of CMML. There are key differences between WHO and ICC related to requirements for peripheral blood cytopenias, bone marrow findings, clonality, and flow cytometry features. The real-world implications of these updated systems have not been explored in great detail. So in this present work, Baumgartner and co-investigators retrospectively applied the new criteria to 2,130 oligomonocytosis cases, as well as 3,311 cases previously established as CMML, according to the WHO 2017 criteria. All case samples were analyzed between 2005 and 2022 using cytomorphology, chromosome banding analysis, flow cytometry, panel sequencing, fluorescence in situ hybridization if necessary, and in a subset, whole genome and whole transcriptome sequencing. The most impactful change in the updated classifications was revising the peripheral blood monocytosis threshold from 1 to 0.5 times 10 to the 9th per liter. In the cohort of 2,130 oligomonocytosis cases, 11% were newly classified as myelodysplastic CMML, according to the ICC 2022 criteria. Applying the WHO 2022 criteria resulted in reclassification of 17% as CMML. So WHO 2022 reclassified 1.5 times more oligomonocytosis cases as compared to ICC 2022, primarily due to differences between the two systems in bone marrow-specific CMML criteria. For the cohort of previously established CMML cases, the 2022 criteria reclassified nearly 42% of cases. Elimination of CMML0 subgroup, which by WHO 2017 criteria included 37.6% of cases, increased the size of the CMML1 subgroup from 39.7% to 57.1% when applying the ICC 2022 criteria, and to 73.4% when applying the WHO 2022 criteria. By eliminating the clinical criteria of persisting monocytosis, the number of cases no longer classified as CMML was 23.4% when applying the ICC 2022 criteria, and 3.1% with the WHO 2022 criteria. Finally, due to the revised AML diagnostic criteria, the number of CMML cases reclassified as AML was 1.1% using the ICC 2022 criteria, and 2.7% using WHO 2022. Compared to established CMML cases, the reclassified cases had distinct mutational and transcriptional profiles, yet survival was similar. The newly classified CMML cases exhibited strong enrichment of MDS typical alterations. Median overall survival was significantly superior for patients with myelodysplastic CMML, as compared to those with myeloproliferative CMML, at 6.7 years and 4.0 years, respectively. And for the CMML cases newly classified by either the ICC or WHO criteria, median overall survival did not significantly differ from the established myelodysplastic CMML cohort. Altogether, authors say, this work suggests newly classified CMML sits on a disease continuum between MDS and previously established CMML. They say this transitional state, which has its own distinct clinical and molecular profile, should be further evaluated in future studies. In a commentary, Luca Malcavati of Policlinico San Matteo in Pavia, Italy, says this study offers the most comprehensive analysis to date of patients with monocytosis in a routine diagnostic setting, and reveals relevant insights into the implications of the newly proposed classification systems. According to Malcavati, the results suggest the WHO criteria reclassify a higher proportion of MDS as CMML, but appear less specific in capturing myeloproliferative features. Conversely, the ICC criteria appear less sensitive, but significantly more specific in capturing a proliferative footprint. Despite these differences, the current results demonstrate comparable survival between established and newly classified cases, corroborating the notion of a continuum between MDS and MDS-MPN. And Malkavati adds, it supports the identification of meaningful disease subgroups based on specific genetic signatures rather than arbitrary thresholds of monocyte count. Our final article is Targeting the Tissue Factor Coagulation Initiation Complex Prevents Antiphospholipid Antibody Development. And the first author is Nadine Muller-Kaleha of the Center for Thrombosis and Hemostasis and the Institute of Clinical Chemistry and Laboratory Medicine at Johannes Gutenberg University Medical Center in Mainz, Germany. Antiphospholipid syndrome is a systemic autoimmune disorder that is potentially life-threatening and challenging to manage. This syndrome is characterized by the persistent presence of antiphospholipid antibodies that are reactive with coagulation regulatory proteins, leading to thrombotic disease manifestations, pregnancy complications, and other adverse outcomes. Preventing the development of these autoantibodies is an unmet clinical need. Current management strategies for antiphospholipid syndrome are largely focused on therapeutic anticoagulation. The available treatments may help prevent thromboembolic events, but generally do not attenuate antiphospholipid antibody titers. Thus, a closer look at the pathogenic mechanisms behind antiphospholipid antibody development is warranted. As noted, these autoantibodies can cross-react with various coagulation regulatory proteins. It's been shown that antiphospholipid antibodies recognize LBPA, or lysobiphosphatidic acid. This phospholipid is presented by the cell surface endothelial protein C receptor, or EPCR, which plays a key role in the protein C anticoagulant pathway. This specific recognition of LBPA leads to complement-mediated activation of tissue factor-dependent pro-inflammatory signaling and thrombosis. And, as authors of the current research article note, coagulation initiated by tissue factor is central to the thrombotic complications seen in patients with antiphospholipid syndrome. The engagement of EPCR-LBPA has been implicated in the persistent production of antiphospholipid antibodies in experimental models of antiphospholipid syndrome and systemic lupus erythematosus. And beyond autoimmune diseases, coagulation activation by tissue factor is a hallmark of viral infections and contributes to thromboinflammation in severe COVID-19. In the present research article, authors further explore the role of tissue factor in the development of antiphospholipid antibodies. Their proof-of-concept experiments involve specific blockade of the tissue factor coagulation initiation complex with the nematode-derived anticoagulant protein C2, NAPC2. The work was conducted in a series of experimental animal models of antiphospholipid syndrome, IVC thrombosis, CMV infection, and systemic lupus erythematosus. The results show that tissue factor plays a critical role in the pathogenic effects of antiphospholipid antibodies and the B1 cells that generate them. The experiments as described in blood show that, in mice, NAPC2 prevents the prothrombotic effects of COVID-19 patient-derived antiphospholipid antibodies. Specifically, NAPC2 inhibited development of antibodies against beta-2 glycoprotein 1, the primary antigen in antiphospholipid syndrome and EPCR. Furthermore, NAPC2 attenuated pro-inflammatory and prothrombotic activation of monocytes induced by antiphospholipid antibodies. Stabilization of the tissue factor initiation complex had far-reaching effects. The intervention not only inhibited antiphospholipid antibody signaling, but also preserved the induction of monocyte interferon responses that are relevant to antimicrobial host defense. Taken together, authors say, their data demonstrates a tissue factor-dependent mechanism of antiphospholipid antibody development in viral infection and autoimmune disease. They say the work provides initial evidence that in antiphospholipid syndrome, specific targeting of the tissue factor initiation complex could have therapeutic benefits beyond the anticoagulant strategies currently used in clinical practice. In a commentary on these findings, Philip G. de Groot of Synapse Research Institute in Maastricht, the Netherlands, asks whether the mystery of autoantibodies has been solved. DeGroote says the authors have identified tissue factor as vital for the development of autoantibodies against phospholipids. Beyond that, they show that tissue factor is critical to the development of autoreactive B1 cells that generate the autophospholipid antibodies. However, further research is needed. For example, DeGroote suggests that the autoantibodies mediated by tissue factor could be better characterized in mouse models. Are these the transient antiphospholipid antibodies often seen following infectious diseases, or the persistent antibodies responsible for thrombotic complications? Another compelling question is whether transient autoantibodies are in an early stage of transition to persistent antibodies, and if so, what causes the switch? Nevertheless, the current findings are significant, particularly as this is the first publication to show that tissue factor is an essential intermediate for antiphospholipid antibody generation. You have been listening to the Blood Podcast. For a list of additional authors, as well as more detailed articles and commentaries on which this podcast is based, please go to bloodjournal.org. Be sure to join us next week for another episode. Thank you for listening.